Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, it's the local news roundup. Next week, the North Carolina General Assembly starts its short session, and a proposed constitutional amendment capping property tax rates has Mecklenburg leaders sounding the alarm. On Wednesday, lawmakers advanced a bill in committee that would limit property rate increases by cities and counties. Officials from Charlotte City Government and Mecklenburg County joined CMS leaders at a forum this week where they called the amendment a bad idea. CMS Intergovernmental Relations Director Charles Jeter warned of significant damage.
If this happens, it'll almost be impossible to undo, and it will have a detrimental impact on every child in this community, every resident of this community, and every service that this community provides.
Meanwhile, CMPD released crime statistics for the first 3 months of 2026 with mostly good news. Overall, crime is down by 23%, but one trend is alarming. Homicides went up 38% in the first quarter year over year. 22 people were murdered in Charlotte compared with 16 in 2025. CMPD Chief Stella Patterson said during a news conference this week that the majority of homicides involve people who know each other.
We're not seeing necessarily that we know of where there's like gang activity and that kind of thing, where there's repeated retaliation and that kind of thing. It appears that most of our homicides, the victim and the suspect, were known to one another.
Safety also lies at the heart of a new funding request from Charlotte Area Transit System and policy debate in Raleigh over involuntary commitments. And finally, Charlotte's passion for the NBA Hornets has brought Buzz City back to life. Here's Miles Bridges of the Hornets after Charlotte eliminated Miami on Tuesday night in overtime.
I mean, I think both teams didn't want to go home, but us for sure, you know, because we had such a great year. We started off bad. And we banded together and we, you know, created a culture here. So we want to win for our fans, win for ourselves, and, you know, get a taste of playoff basketball.
The Hornets play Orlando tonight. A win would send Charlotte to the playoffs for the first time in a decade. Here to help me discuss these stories and more, we have reporter Hunter Sines from WSOC, Alex Sands of Axios Charlotte, David Hodges is WBTV's investigative reporter, and James Farrell covers education for WFAE. Good morning and welcome to you all.
Morning, Aaron. Good morning.
All right, David, let's begin with this proposed amendment to cap property taxes. Here is what House Speaker Destin Hall said on PBSNC State Lines in December while discussing the Republican caucus's goals for the short session.
What we've seen really across the state, and it's been different in different areas, but really across the state, property values have increased, and we know that one of the functions of property tax is the value of that property. And so folks have seen those bills go up, and we're really going to look at both sides of the ledger, not just the issue of local property taxes, but we're taking a look at local governments. Are they wisely spending these dollars? We think some of the larger counties, some of the larger cities probably are not, probably spending money on things that are not essential services, not things dealing with law enforcement and EMS, but things dealing with stuff that local government really shouldn't be spending its time and attention on, like DEI-related policies. We're going to look at what we might be able to do on the expense side to decrease some of that from being spent at the local government level.
And here we are today, David. How would this work and why now?
Yeah, so how this would work is what's called a levy limit, and it's a little complicated to explain, but I think the simplest way to talk about it is if this were to all pass, if the General Assembly were to create this constitutional amendment, which voters would have to approve, it would limit how much local governments could raise from property taxes year to year. So think about it less of a rate, but more like how much money the government can take in, the local government can take in year to year. And this is being talked about because if you live in North Carolina, if you live in Charlotte, you know that your property values have absolutely skyrocketed over the past several years. And even though we've seen rates decrease in Mecklenburg County, because properties are valued so much more highly, it's still leading to property tax increases for a lot of people. out of Cabarrus County, Wake County, Durham County are some of the places where the crunch is being felt the most right now. And that's why state lawmakers are talking about this and trying to come up with some different potential solutions on this, much to the chagrin of local lawmakers.
And this needs supermajority approval from both chambers, which is 60% of the votes. Mm-hmm. And then it would appear, if that happens, it would then appear on the November ballot where a simple majority would decide its fate, correct?
Yes, that is correct. So supermajority means 60% in the North Carolina House, as well as the Senate, which Republicans maybe could get with the help of, I think they need the help of a Democrat or so in there as well. And trying to do it in the short session means they'd have to move pretty quickly on this. And even some of the Republicans who were talking at the committee hearing on Wednesday mentioned that this seems like a lot to try and pull off in a short session.
And David, you just mentioned to the chagrin of local government leaders. We heard from CMS's Charles Jeter at the start of the show. Here's what Mecklenburg County Manager Mike Bryant had to say.
A one-size-fit-all solution that is dictated by Raleigh doesn't provide local elected officials the flexibility you need to respond to the challenges of our residents.
So Alex, what kind of damage do opponents think this would cause?
Yeah, I think that the reason you're going to hear a lot of opposition coming out of Mecklenburg County is because this is kind of the one thing that they have control over is the property tax. And just like look at the transportation referendum we just had, how much that took years to get passed because they wanted a sales tax. And then like the school bond, trying to get money to build schools, that was a huge process. So they're kind of feeling threatened that they're going to lose this piece of control they have at the same time that the CMS system is really struggling because of cuts to public education from coming down all the way from the federal government. State funding for teacher pay is up in the air because we don't have a budget right now. At the same time, the Charlotte Observer had a story this week about how CMS has over 20 employees making over $200,000 a year, while Wake County, which is a larger district, only has 3 employees making that much. So it's kind of like people in Raleigh are going to look at that and they're going to say, yeah, you guys can raise property taxes if you and say you don't have enough money, but are you spending that money appropriately?
David, you mentioned Cabarrus County. Cabarrus County Republican Brian Echevarria says a levy limit will curb the steep costs of property revaluations, which I think you were referring to. Here's what he had to say about that.
Under the current property tax system, when tax assessed values rise sharply, property tax bills can increase substantially. Even without any change or with the we didn't raise your taxes reduction in the local rate. However, nothing changes for the people.
David, that sounds like the kind of soundbite that may resonate with voters. What's your impression of how this might be received?
The Republicans who are discussing this in Raleigh feel extremely confident that if they pass this with a supermajority and it gets on the ballot, that it will ultimately pass. Because let's be honest, who would vote against something on a ballot that says, give us the ability to limit how much your property taxes are increased? I think that there's a whole lot of unknowns about how this would work, though. The language that currently exists is just give the General Assembly the authority to limit increases. That's a lot of potential power and a lot of potential unknowns. And the point that local government is going to have to make, and it's a much more difficult point to make, is maybe some of the reason that property taxes are increasing at the county and city level more is because of unfunded mandates from the General Assembly. So it's easy to say we're going to limit how much you're able to raise taxes as we underfund how much money we're giving you for your school districts, court systems, and other serious services.
And that ties back a little bit to what Alex was saying about the challenge for local government. Last week, County Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell linked the proposed property tax cap to the dismissal of the Leandro case.
The Supreme Court just tossing out the Leandro or overturning the Leandro decision at the same time as this power grab. It just is outrageous, and I really feel like the state is driving us off a cliff, and I don't know that the public is totally getting it.
And that's the interesting point about this, I think, to what you were just saying, David, is who can get that message across more clearly. And it is so easy to say, hey, are you tired of paying higher taxes versus the nuances of, you know, what is the state funding? What should they be funding? Why are county and city government having to fill in those blanks? So if you're in local government, what do you do? Do you just pound the message over and over?
I think the stronger message for local government might be to move away from the discussion on the property tax rate and instead look at what the Republican lawmakers did on Wednesday with some of the possible options that they had to consider for limiting property taxes, and specifically focus on the discussion that was had about hospitals. There were two different proposals about cutting property tax exemptions and sales tax exemptions for hospitals. And Representative Julia Howard, who's a Republican, said out loud that she got calls, that all of them got calls from powerful lobbyists, and the hospitals really didn't want to see this pass. I think she literally said, they did not want me to say this out loud. And another representative said, yes, you weren't supposed to talk about this. So if I'm a local government official, I'm pointing at that as, is this something that is actually helpful to you, or is this just more of a political maneuver?
And I guess along those lines, how much of this do you believe is partisan, sort of the continuation of the rural ex-urban versus urban that we've seen in Raleigh for years?
I think there's definitely a Republican, Democrat, big city, smaller government situation going on here. But I think maybe the bigger takeaway from this is the battle that's increasing between the General Assembly and local governments just at large. I mean, you have local Republican-controlled counties, cities, towns that don't want to see this just as much as Democrat areas like Mecklenburg County and Wake. The General Assembly over the last few years has just taken a lot of steps to remove more local control from counties, from towns, and from cities. And a lot of it doesn't have anything to do with what's happening in Charlotte. In fact, Charlotte and Mecklenburg County have a case to be made that they're raising tax rates at a much lower rate than some of these other counties that I previously mentioned, such as Cabarrus.
Speaking of Raleigh, James, you reported this week on Charlotte residents urging school system leaders to push harder for a new state budget. Yes, we are 2.5 months away from the end of a fiscal year that still does not have a new budget. So what do they want CMS leaders to do, and what is realistic that CMS leaders can do?
Yeah, we touched on this a little bit with the ending of Leandro. I think that's really sparking a lot of this conversation, as well as this whole property tax constitutional amendment. You know, CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill was really trying to make the point at this last school board meeting that so many of CMS's budgetary problems that they're facing this year, kind of a tight budget, is because of underfunding from the state. Of course, we also know declining enrollment is also playing a role in that. They had to hire 200 fewer positions because of declining enrollment, as many other school districts did. So I think all of that together is kind of creating a narrative for pro-public education advocates that the state is underfunding schools and the state has to do more. And there's been kind of a push for to get CMS to try to do more at the state level. Now, to your question, I don't know what more they could do potentially. That's kind of a difficult thing for I think CMS would tell you they've been trying to do that for a long time. But I think that there's just some frustration that's kind of bubbling to the surface as we're seeing the budget come out, as we're seeing cuts to central office positions, teachers being moved around because of the declining enrollment and things like that. And I think that's kind of just a response to all of that.
Alex.
Yeah, Dustin Hall was in Charlotte last week, and he talked about how he wants North Carolina to be the number one in the South for starting teacher pay. I thought that was interesting. I think that's been one of his talking points, but I just hadn't heard it much. But then, you know, this week, we're also hearing that South Carolina was actually pitching a higher number. We were looking at 50,000. I think they were looking at 51,000. So
interesting. We will be talking a lot more about this in the coming weeks. We need to take a break. We will discuss transit and safety when we return. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing the Local News Roundup. Our panel includes Alex Sands of Axios Charlotte, Hunter Sines from WSOC, David Hodges from WBTV, and James Farrell of WFAE. This week, there were a couple of things going on with transit and public safety that emanated from the fatal stabbing of Irina Zarutska on a CATS train last summer. The first instance came from CATS itself. The transit agency this week asked for an additional $10 million in its safety and security budget. Hunter, how would the money be spent?
So the money is wanting to be spent to try to boost security and also fare evasion. Of course, as you mentioned, it comes after the Irina Zarudska murder on our Blue Line. So part of this money would create a fare evasion team, which would be a first. Their sole responsibility would be to go out and make sure that everyone on board our transit system, buses and light rail, would have a ticket to be actually riding them. And then it would also continue the program that they have initiated since Zarudska's death, which is a program where off-duty CMPD officers are paid for additional security on our light rail system. It would fund roughly 1,400 hours a week for off-duty CMPD officers. Interesting, though, Eric, is that we have seen a pretty significant boost in security funding for CATS over the years. I think it was from like 2022 to 2025. It was nearly like $6 million of an increase, and they were spending almost like, I think it was more than $18 million on safety for our CAT system. This would bring it up to $31.8 million in total spending for it. So
we're talking like a 50% increase.
A significant increase, correct.
CATS interim CEO Brent Cagle told council this week that 50% of CATS riders aren't paying to ride, and that is costing the transit agency $3 million to $5 million a year. This might be grossly oversimplified and reductive, but when you look at it on the surface, why does it make sense to spend $10 million more to get half or less of that back?
You know, I'm not a business person, but I would say on the forefront, when you build a system that you have to think of the millions that went into building what we already have, and then you don't have the checks and balances to make sure that you're making any money, yet alone you're losing $3 to $5 million a year, I think a lot of people will have similar questions as why are we boosting so many more millions than we are, and we're already losing at least that. And so I'm not sure where the numbers will even out. If the argument is, if we actually do fare evasion policy and actually try to make sure that everyone going on board our trains and our buses actually have a paid ticket, if funding that, they believe in the long term, maybe a decade or two decades further, will actually bring that profitability up. I'm not sure. I will say this is going to go in front of council several more times. I think there's a public hearing in May on it. So it's likely that this could change, especially as more discussion gets underway.
David?
I think it's also about optics and safety as well. I mean, you know, it's hard. I remember back when we were doing investigations about CATS and previous iterations, to ask taxpayers to foot a bill for something and then simultaneously say we are not collecting 50% of fare revenues is kind of a hard argument to make, even though the math might make sense on it. And the other issue, of course, is DeCarlos Brown Jr., who was accused of stabbing Irina Zarudska. He had not paid to get on the bus. He had not paid to get on the light rail. I've been on the light rail when I've seen some of these security officers as well as CMPD officers check somebody's fare and then ask them to leave. And it can get a little tense in those cabs when that's happening. So fare evasion is a way to step up security as well.
Yeah, a lot of the argument, right, David, is that by enforcing fares, making sure people are paying fares, you're kind of weeding out some of the trouble in advance.
Some, but a lot of the people who aren't paying fares are people who could definitely pay for fares as they're going to Hornets games, Panthers games. I wonder how many people who are riding the light rail into work every day are paying the fares.
Another aspect of this Transit and safety focus surfaced Tuesday in Raleigh. The House Select Committee on Involuntary Commitment and Public Safety released its final report, and Representative Tim Reeder, a Republican from Pitt County who co-chairs that committee, had this to say about involuntary commitment.
This is a big issue that has taken decades to get to where we are today, and so we're not going to solve it in the few months that we've had, but we want to continue to make incremental steps forward.
So, Hunter, where does this look like it's going? And give us a little context on how we got here.
Okay, so a lot of this also has to do with the aftermath of Irina Zarudzka's death. The suspect in her case, DeCarlos Brown, had been involuntarily committed before. Of course, he allegedly misused the 911 system right before getting on that train, saying that somebody was controlling his mind. So it made the argument that, are we doing enough for in IVC policy to try to prevent people from doing this type of harm and really getting the resources that they may need? So they started looking at the involuntary commitment policies that we have, which is very complex. It is very overburdened. We don't have enough resources, enough people to do it. It puts our hospitals, it taxes our hospitals, really. So what they're looking at is they're actually looking at New York State's outpatient care for a bit of inspiration on what we could possibly do here. So a couple of just highlights. So they're wanting to see and make sure that the Department of Health and Human Services and the judicial system communicate better. So when you have somebody who's arrested, magistrates don't always have access to that suspect's clinical records right there in front of them to make a determination of, do they need mental health? Do they need a secured bond? Whatever it may be. So Arena's Law dips into that. I know Alex may mention that here in a bit, but they want to make sure that they also, that clinicians do have access to patients' criminal records as well. They also want to change the law to where it limits who can conduct involuntary commitment evaluations, and they want more people to be certified. So that it sounds like there is a want to increase the capacity of IVCs that we're able to do right now. It's difficult to do it. It's a long process, and a lot of people get caught in the process. And then one more highlight is, I know the sheriff has told us, Sheriff McFadden, that this is a problem of transportation. So somebody comes into the jail, they need to be IVC'd. They have to transport them to the hospital. That takes resources and time. So lawmakers are looking at trying to see if it can be done online in the jail itself, just to try to get that kink out of the system.
That's the voice of Hunter Sines from WSOC. He's here with us on the Local News Roundup with James Farrell from WFAE, David Hodges from WBTV, and Alex Sands from Axios Charlotte. And Alex, Hunter set you up nicely. Tell us a little bit about Arena's Law and how this is evolving, including this particular policy that was being discussed this week.
Mm-hmm. Arena's Law, it was pushed through really quickly just because, you know, that murder caught so much national attention and people really wanted to act fast on it. So it had tightened some pretrial release for violent offenses. So more people were going to be staying in jail longer. And that was an issue that Sheriff McFadden had because he didn't think the funding was there for that. It also required more mental health evaluations. And one of the big things it did that they're now, because it got pushed through really fast, now they're looking back on it, is that it required officers to take people they were arresting to the emergency room if they thought they had a mental illness. Well, hospitals pushed back on that because they said, we don't have the capacity in our ERs, and it's also not safe to bring people here who are experiencing that. So that's where some of the proposals came into this committee about having some type of online psychiatric evaluation inside the jail virtually, instead of requiring them to bring them to the ER.
David.
Yeah, I think they're definitely looking at doing some telepsychiatry. One of the issues with DeCarlos Brown Jr. was when he was released from jail for this misuse of the 911 system, he was supposed to go to essentially an evaluation that he never did, and it was scheduled like months in advance. If you have a teletherapy system like this, theoretically, you could get people access to an evaluation a whole lot quicker. I wanted to mention to Alex's point too about IRENA's law getting pushed through really quickly. There was a lot in there about these involuntary commitments, evaluations. And as I understand it from speaking with my sources, some state lawmakers who were involved in the healthcare system and law enforcement said, we need to delay a lot of this because you don't know all the problems in the system. This is incredibly complicated. So it's gotten pushed back. And this committee is going to keep meeting for a while. I think they're supposed to have another report due February 1st of 2027, just to give you an idea of the scope of the problem and how complicated this issue is.
Yeah, and Hunter, you referenced that as well. This sounds incredibly complex. Just the idea of involuntary commitment in itself is really knotty and thorny. That doesn't mean you do nothing, but it means you have to be very deliberate with this. In that given that context, how much opposition or pushback are you hearing or seeing to this?
It'll be interesting to see that part of this, Eric, as we mentioned, as it plays out through the long process that it's going to take. I will say, talking with disability rights activists, they will tell you that they are begging lawmakers to bring them and other experts to the table when it comes to mental health and really wraparound services, what works and what doesn't. Some will argue IVC, how it's done here in North Carolina, does not work. It does not help. It does not prevent or get people on the right mental health track. One of the biggest things, Eric, right now is we don't have enough beds for this. I mean, there is a backlog. People are in our hospitals waiting to get sent to an actual psychiatric hospital, taking up beds in a hospital that any of our relatives, when they get sick, may need. So, I mean, that's just one part of the issue. So I think we're going to see a lot of different people chiming in. I think they will welcome the fact, like we mentioned, that this is going to be a long process so that they can hopefully get their points in this.
Hunter, speaking of safety, CMPD, as you know, released first quarter crime statistics this week. What did you take from those numbers?
Yeah, I took that this is a first good first quarter for the new CMPD chief and her leadership, Estella Patterson. I think overall, as we learned, overall crime is down 23%. I'm not going to throw a ton of figures at people right now. So that is down. Violent crime is also down. However, the only thing, as you mentioned at the top of the show, that is up is our homicide rate is technically up 38% from the same first quarter last year. So we have 22 homicides from January to March of this year compared to 16 last year. I will say a lot of people see that headline and they get very concerned and it can get taken out of context. The chief did mention that a lot of these homicides, a lot of the violent crime that we see, people know each other. It is a disagreement that leads to somebody not being able to control themselves, and that's what leads to the crime. We are not seeing a ton of random violent crime, people shooting, you know, drive-bys randomly in a neighborhood. I just wanted to put that in context because a 38% increase can definitely be taken different ways.
And we've heard the police, CMPD, for years saying that it is people who know each other and have too much access to guns and too much temper, and it spirals from there.
Another takeaway very quickly, Eric, is that for a while, Uptown has really had a spotlight on it when it comes to crime and violent crime. Romare Bearden Park, we've had people voice concerns of our homeless population that have been arrested in some violent crimes. And CMPD under previous Chief Johnny Jennings and continuing with Chief Patterson, they've really put a focus on the Center City's Restoration Order of Wellness and Nonviolence. It's called the Crown Culture Initiative. And they've actually been able to work with other law enforcement agencies, whether it be on some weekends and doing these stings where they are getting firearms off the streets that shouldn't be on off the streets. They're making arrests. And the CMPD would argue that they've actually seen some progress in trying to turn the page with crime. At least the perception of crime is what they are fighting right now in Uptown. And I have to give credit where it's due. They have really tried to put an emphasis on that with more resources there in the uptown area.
Alex, one of the big stories here last year was Operation Charlotte's Web, which is the Trump administration's immigration crackdown here. You reported this week on what we're learning about the results and what we're not. I would like you to begin by reminding us how this was organized, what it was intended to do, and then share what we know at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Trump administration surged the Border Patrol resources here because they said they were coming for the worst of the worst criminals. And that, you know, Charlotte is a Democrat area and they were not honoring ICE detainers and kind of just made it sound like we had a bunch of criminals running around. We're starting to slowly get some data now on who they were targeting. And it seems a little bit more like they were, as some people have assumed, just casting a wide net. I'm just going to tell you guys about the first week. WFAE had these numbers that they analyzed from an organization called the Deportation Data Project. And that project is a group of lawyers and academics who sue ICE and DHS for this information because they don't voluntarily give it out. There were 402 people arrested in that first week. So November 15th to the 23rd, just over a quarter, 107 people had prior criminal convictions and nearly half had no criminal record. About 100 had pending charges. So yeah, that's slowly what we're learning. We're learning most of the people went to Georgia. Overwhelming majority were men, and ICE arrests in North Carolina rose by about 240% that week compared to the week prior.
And they were in Charlotte a couple weeks, November, December?
Yeah, I mean, it's another transparency issue. They didn't really say when they were going, but we could, it seems, assume that it was 2 weeks that they were here because we did see them packing up and leaving, and the sheriff had heard they were leaving, and it seemed the activity had slowed down after that based on what people who were closely following them were reporting at the time.
Got it. So a lot more to find out about that. We need to take another break. When we come back, we're talking basketball, LaMelo Ball, and oh, by the way, I-77. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. This is the Local News Roundup. Our panel of reporters features Hunter Sines from WSOC, David Hodges from WBTV, Alex Sands of Axios Charlotte, and WFAE education reporter James Farrell. And James, I think you wanted to add something on our last topic about Operation Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, you know, while the data shows that roughly 100 had pending criminal charges, the data set doesn't include details about the nature of those convictions and those charges, which I think just kind of highlights a little bit what Alex said about the transparency issues here. There's a lot of questions that we still have, even when we get data like this, that's not completely being illuminated. There's still so many uncertainties. You know, our own Julian Berger has reported a lot on this and the efforts he's gone through to try to get some answers about what happened back in November exactly. And that's just another example of how we get some information, but it's still not the full picture of what we're looking for.
And on to David Hodges and his vocabulary lesson for the week. It's déshabillé, which, as you know, David, refers to being partly or informally dressed, which brings me to...
Of course I knew that.
You knew that. Which brings me to this. On Wednesday, an Iredell Superior Court judge ruled that a video of Mooresville Mayor Chris Carney not wearing pants is public record and should be released. This is a story and suit that you and WBTV have been pursuing for many months. So what does this ruling mean and what are you trying to find out?
Yeah, so our lawsuit is all about transparency and trying to get to the bottom of the truth, essentially. So back in October of 2024, Mayor Chris Carney went to town hall after midnight with a female companion. Motion detectors were tripped a couple different times. Police showed up. He was there until after 4 a.m. in the morning. I interviewed him about it, and then I filed a records request for these police records as well as the video from CCTV cameras at Mooresville Town Hall. We filed that record request because we believe it's a public record, and because we believe in transparency and we're trying to fight for the truth for the people of Mooresville. Of course, we did the interview with the mayor, but we're trying to find out for sure what's going on. Just this week, a judge agreed with our interpretation that these records are indeed public and not a protected piece of security information, such as the town was arguing. We are supposed to get the video either in 5 business days, which would be April 22nd, but the town also has the option of providing the video to the judge and proposing certain redactions in case there's anything on the video that the judge believes shouldn't be a public record.
And the debate or argument at this point is not about what the mayor was or wasn't wearing. It's about the circumstances of why he was wearing what he was wearing.
It was even there in the first place. And I mean, we're not the only ones who are asking questions about this. The town board in Mooresville voted 4-2 earlier this month, a no confidence against the mayor and requesting his resignation. And it pretty much had to do entirely with this incident. So this is beyond our investigation now, and the town board even has serious questions about what happened that night and what the mayor was doing at town hall.
Serious questions as well this week at Charlotte Douglas International Airport, where an American Airlines pilot slammed on his brakes to avoid a truck as the plane taxied. Here's the pilot's reaction, courtesy of ABC News.
So that white black truck, they just went right in front of us, and we nearly hit them. I had to slam on the brakes. We had our taxi light on. We started moving. They need to be. Someone's got to be talking about it right away. That was really bad.
Hunter, any idea yet how or why this happened?
So important context where this happened. It looked so. They actually Charlotte Douglas put out the video of this incident, I believe, yesterday, and it looks like the airplane is actually coming out of one of the gate areas. And we see, you know, where you see usually baggage trucks coming and everything. This was an actual pickup truck. My understanding, operations truck that drive through there. They are allowed to do so, but the air traffic control does not have jurisdiction of the area this close to where the gates are. So policy is that any type of vehicle is supposed to yield to planes. When you think about it in the cockpit, you don't have, but you can't really see as the pilot. You have a windshield that's very small. You can't see below. So thankfully, they were able to see this and stop. They were going pretty slowly. However, you do see on the video a sudden jolt. Charlotte Douglas Airport is looking into how this could have happened. I will say, the plane was just starting to move. So playing devil's advocate, perhaps the driver of the car didn't realize that the plane was actually in full motion. It's not like we've seen other ones that are landing and going 100 miles an hour. So this is concerning, though, of course, Eric, because we have had instances at other airports here recently like this. We have the one at Los Angeles International Airport where a Frontier Airlines jet nearly hit 2 trucks that were crossing in front of them. And then, of course, last month, the Air Canada Express jet landing at LaGuardia, where the 2 pilots were killed after hitting the fire truck that did not have the alert system.
Got it. Yeah. One other airport note this week, Reuters and Bloomberg reported on a conversation between Scott Kirby, the United Airlines CEO, and President Trump at the White House about a possible merger of United and American Airlines. This reportedly occurred on February 25th. Combining the two airlines, which are 2 of the largest in the world, would likely bring seismic changes to the industry, but no one's commenting, and analysts seem to think it's unlikely. Worth watching locally because American, as many people know, has its 2nd largest hub at Charlotte Douglas, and American accounts for about 90% of the flights to and from the airport. So we'll keep an eye on that. But let's move to a slower travel mode, sitting in traffic on I-77. James, on Monday, Sustain Charlotte co-hosted a forum for professionals and residents to present ideas and designs for the 11-mile stretch of 77 that is targeted for elevated and widened lanes that would be used by drivers paying tolls. This has caused all kinds of headaches for people on all sides. So what were some of the suggestions that were shown off on Monday?
Yeah, so my colleague Elvis Meneasse covered this event. There were a little bit more than 30 proposals that came from everyone, from professional architects to there's actually a 10-year-old who submitted a proposal. And a lot of the proposals focused on trying to find more green space, keeping the community connected, adding bike lanes. There was one proposal that had an autonomous shuttle system that would carry people across, so more of kind of a transit focused approach as opposed to, you know, using the roads and all that. So it's just really interesting to see all of the kind of like creative different responses. I think it shows some of the nuance in this debate that we're seeing, that it's not necessarily all just like, oh, we're anti, you know, anything. There's kind of this whole slew of different proposals that have been brought forward from people who are really passionate about this and who really want to see alternatives to what's been suggested that's obviously been so controversial in the community.
I'm curious what the sense of optimism may have been given what seemed like long odds for some of these alternatives to be seriously considered.
Yeah, I think that's tough to say at this point. I mean, obviously, we know the state has paused this process. We know they've made some comments about studying the feasibility of a cap. They've talked about maybe having some of the contractors pitch sort of more creative designs. So we know that they at least are saying they're listening. The organizers of this event with Sustain Charlotte said they're going to be submitting all of these to the state as well. But I think that more than anything, it kind of just gave the community an opportunity to feel like they're getting their voices heard and getting these different ideas out there that maybe have not been discussed in these public forums that we've been seeing in these kinds of public debates over what's going on.
Got it. That's the voice of James Farrell from WFAE. He is here as part of the local news roundup with Hunter Sines, David Hodges, and Alex Sands. And Alex, I think you had a point to add to that.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that most of the designs that I didn't go to the event, but most of the designs I saw afterwards, I got a few of them from Sustain Charlotte, and they all incorporated freeway caps, which is something that is a viable option in Charlotte because Dallas does it and Detroit's looking at doing it, and it would be hundreds of millions of dollars, but this is uptown and I think we're talking about a lot of high value land here, so it's just kind of interesting to think about if you have, when you actually look at these visuals and you think like if we had the political will, it would be an interesting thing to see instead of highway infrastructure going through these parts of uptown to have a 5-acre park.
David, as someone who covers political will a lot, you may not be tracking this one day to day, but just as you look at it from afar, what do you think the chances are that we're going to see significant change in the design of this project?
I think it's pretty unlikely. You never know on these things, but it appears to me that while sure, not very much of the design phase is technically done, this is the direction this is going. My personal opinion, the one thing that could possibly change that is how many people decide to run for mayor next time around and want to wear this around their neck if toll lanes are really that unpopular. So that's what I'm really watching to see is possibly curtailing this entire project.
Alex, something that's very popular, as you know, is the rail trail in South End. And you reported this week that it is going to be out of service a little bit here in the next few months. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with the rail trail and why it's going to have to be closed.
Yeah, the rail trail, we're looking at that area right outside where Old Sycamore Brewing is, the new Club West, kind of between that area and down, if you guys ever go to Stable Hand Coffee Shop. That trail is insane on any day of the week at like 5 p.m., especially during these months, right? They're closing it Sunday, so people are very concerned that, where is all that traffic going to go? It's basically, sometimes it's a bottleneck, that's how crazy it is. But I think that speaks to also how important this project is that they're doing, because they're closing it so they can build this pedestrian crossing and they can build a light rail station, just because there's been so much development and there's been so much growth in that area that they think that they need to add something there for the Blue Line to alleviate just how congested it gets.
And how long is this?
It's going to be, so the rail trail is closed through July, but they say it's going to reopen in segments between May and July. I'm a little skeptical about that construction timeline, but that's just me. and the actual light rail station is going to open in 2028. also we should expect to see some Blue Line light rail closure. So it's going to probably be out of service sometime later this month. And then possibly we'll have some more interruptions after that because they're doing track work and they'll have to stop running the train in that area.
Got it. David, I want to come back to something that we did not cover earlier when we were talking about City Council and some of the items from this week. And that is, we saw and heard council members on Monday sparring a little bit over an expected request for possible incentives for the Stellar Gospel Music Awards, an event that organizers and tourism leaders say will bring 5,000 visitors to town in August. What are council members upset about?
Well, they're very excited about this event coming to Charlotte. They all made that point. It is the biggest gospel award ceremony in the entire country. What frustrated them is the timeline in which this is happening. They're talking about this now when this event is happening in August, and that also when they did the big press conference announcing this and everybody was high-fiving and patting each other on the back, there was really no mention that there would likely be a request for taxpayer dollars from the city of Charlotte to help in some way fund this event happening. Councilmember Ajmera asked what fund would this be coming from. The city manager, Marcus Jones, said it could be the tourism bucket, it could be the general fund bucket. That raised a few eyebrows. But even Councilmembers Mayfield and Anderson were a little skeptical about this ask happening now, just months in advance of this, and not being informed about it right away when the event was announced in Charlotte.
Any idea how much money we might be talking about?
They did not indicate that at all in the meeting, which I think is another contentious point for some of the city council members. I mean, I can understand where they're coming from and some of this frustration. It's so fun and exciting to announce an event like this and then be kind of hit with this on the other side. Feels like you've been bamboozled a little bit. There's been about $1 million that has been dedicated from the state's gambling tax fund, essentially, mm-hmm. but no idea yet on the local ask.
On Tuesday night, something happened here for the first time in a decade. The Hornets played a basketball game at Spectrum Center beyond the regular season. Not technically the playoffs, but the NBA's play-in tournament to determine the last four teams that will be in the playoffs starting this weekend. The Hornets beat Miami in an overtime thriller, step one. And if they beat the Magic in Orlando tonight, they will clinch a playoff spot. David, what's going on around here? First, we had the Panthers in January back in the playoffs after a seven-year lull. Now the Hornets, is Charlotte regaining sports mojo?
I think this is peak Charlotte sports era, at least in the time that I've been here since 2018. I know you've got a little more history than me here, Eric. So, and I don't mean that in an offensive way,
easy,
obviously.
Easy.
but this basketball team is good. I mean, they have been on an absolute tear since the beginning of the season. They started off like any Hornets team typically does in horrible losing form, but they have picked it up. And since before the middle of the season, they really are one of the hottest teams in all of basketball. If you did not watch the game on Tuesday, you really missed out being a part of the city. It was an unbelievable sports event filled with all the drama, including technical difficulties that put the game off screen for about 48 seconds towards the end there. Without trying to jinx this for the Hive, they should be able to beat what I believe is a putrid Orlando Magic.
Putrid, you say. And you're right, though. So much.
Don't blame me, Charlotte, if we lose now.
So much happened Tuesday night. It was a blur. LaMelo Ball scored a team-high 30 points and the winning basket. He was also involved in a collision that resulted in Miami's Bam Adebayo suffering a back injury. Here's what he said afterwards.
I apologize on that one. I mean, I got hit in the head, didn't really know where I was, but I'm going to check on him and see if he's okay and everything.
The NBA subsequently fined LaMelo Ball $35,000 for a flagrant foul and another $25,000 for using a word you're not supposed to use on national television. But he will be playing tonight. Yesterday, head coach Charles Lee shared his perspective on what the Hornets need to do tonight.
I think the things that we have been able to figure out a little bit are just, you know, how we need to guard. But then also offensively playing with some pace, I think, has helped us not allow them to be able to be as physical as they usually are.
So, David, you're on record. This is a W tonight.
This has to be a W. This Magic team has not been playing with its top two players from the season. They look disjointed. This Hornets team is for real. And they could even go into the next round and challenge the number one seed. I'm saying.
Wow. There's the last word. That comes from David Hodges. My thanks also to James Farrell, Alex Sands, and Hunter Sines. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.